you're going on a diet and then off a diet. I mean, we really have to talk about lifestyles. I mean, this is the way you eat for the rest of your life. And so when you think about it that way, okay, what's going to be my lifestyle in terms of what I'm going to eat? Well, then obviously you have to eat a diet that's going to decrease your risk of chronic health. I mean, you know, and look, there's only one diet ever proven to reverse heart disease, number one killer of men and women, at least here in the States and around much of the world, and that's a plant-based diet. So anytime someone tries to sell you on some new diet they've heard about, you know, do me a favor, ask them, wait a second, has this diet been proven to reverse heart disease? You know, the number one or two reason me and all my loved ones will die? The answer is no. Why would you even consider it? The reason why I do what I do is I owe my grandma, actually. I was just a kid when my grandma was diagnosed with end-stage heart disease and sent home to die. She had already had so many bypass operations, she basically run out of plumbing at some point, confined to a wheelchair, crushing chest pain. Her life was over at age 65. But then she heard about this guy, Nathan Pritikin, one of our early lifestyle medicine pioneers. And what happened next is actually detailed in Pritikin's biography. It talks about Frances Greger, my grandmother, arrived in a wheelchair. And they put her on a plant-based diet, started a great exercise program. Within 3 weeks, she's not only out of her wheelchair, she's walking 10 miles a day, went on to live another 31 years on this planet till age 96, enjoy her 6 grandkids, including me. That's why I went into medicine. That's why I started NutritionFacts.org, and that's why I wrote the book, How Not to Die.
All right, Dr. Greger, thank you so much for joining the symposium. It's really an honor to have you here. In 2004, you published a book called Carbophobia, where you stated that low-carb diets, especially animal-based low-carb diets, could be potentially harmful. Can you share with us why?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, at that point, we had lots of observational data. You know, we had these large cohorts of people, hundreds of thousands of people followed, and those people reading, these diets that were more low-carb diets, higher in saturated fat, were having worse health outcomes. But it was just really the beginning of this low-carb craze. Now we actually have this long-term data, so that, you know, it was over a decade ago, and now we actually see the ravages that that's had on these populations that really did take this kind of sharp turn into kind of bacon-butter-rich diets. The results were as devastating as we would expect from these early interventional trials, where you have a video where where I have pictures of showing the heart scans, the cardiac blood flow before and after, going on a plant-based diet, before and after going on a low-carb diet, and you see the dramatic shift. This squeezing down of blood flow on a low carb diet, this opening up of blood flow on a plant based diet, and indeed that's what you see. So what happens when you eat lots of these high animal protein diets? Increase your risk of all the leading killers around the world, these chronic diseases such as diabetes, certain forms of cancer, heart disease, high blood pressure, it's not necessarily. The carbohydrate content. I mean, there are healthy low-carb foods, there are healthy high-carb foods. If by low-carb one means, eating lots of, meat, eggs, and cheese, well, then obviously that's an abysmal diet, and you'll end up with, at high risk for the diseases caused by eating an abysmal diet. Whereas, there's low-carb foods, nuts, seeds, avocados, these are high-fat foods, but these are whole plant foods, these are health-promoting foods. Saying, well, are carbs good or bad? Well, it's like, well, what's the source, right? So carbs are lentils or lollipops, as Dr. Katz likes to say. Same thing with high protein diet, low protein, it's the source of that protein, right? So fat, is fat good? Fat can be lard, can be tallow, can be hydrogenated oil, Crisco, or it can be walnuts, one of the healthiest sources. Protein could be kidney beans or it could be pork rinds. You really have to, what's the source, right? We don't eat nutrients, we eat food. Right, so telling people the reason you hear things like cut down on saturated fatty acids is because it's politically unpalatable for institutions to say cut down on meat. And so they put it in kind of biochemical terms. I mean, so they have to, you know, so, I mean, they have to, you know, the science says, you know, you got, so they say, but they don't say eat more vitamin C. They say eat more fruits and vegetables, right? Why? Because it's the fruits and vegetables, right? And so the same thing. And so they should just come out and say what they're saying. So by saying, yeah, cut down your intake of saturated fat, dietary cholesterol, and trans fats, they're saying cut down meat, eggs, dairy, and junk. I mean, that's the code for cut down meat, eggs, dairy, and junk. I wish they'd be a little more explicit about it to make it easier for people. And so that's it's not so much the macronutrient content; it's which foods are healthier and less healthful. And I think the balance of evidence is clear, going back decades. Just remarkable consistency in the nutritional literature as to the just the foundational underpinnings of what a healthy diet looks like.
That's a great point. But what would you tell to those low carb evangelists that bring up studies like the DIRECT studies or any other trials that actually name good outcomes for a low carb diet? How could this be?
Oh, well, I mean, it depends how you're measuring the outcomes. So typically, you know, so if you were designing a low-carb study, right, because you're funded by the Atkins Corporation or whatever, well, I mean, it's simple to design a study. I mean, that you can, you can restrict food components. I mean, most calories these days, most people kind of living in the Western world, are from these junky refined carbs. You know, they're eating lots of, you know, just refined junk. And so you cut that out, and typically you'll lower the caloric intake and then you lose weight. I mean, you can lose weight cutting any kind of calories out, but restricting your diet in any kind of way, or look, a good cocaine habit will do it, chemotherapy, cancer can do it. There's lots of ways to lose weight, but the goal is not to fit into a skinnier casket. The goal is to find a way to eat that not only gets you to ideal weight, but maximally expands your health span and your lifespan. And that's a healthy diet. So in the short term, you can get people to lose weight on a low-carb diet. You can get people to lose weight on a high-carb diet. But that's not the point. Is, look, diets don't work long-term by definition, because diet kind of infers you're going on a diet and then off a diet. I mean, we really have to talk about lifestyles. I mean, this is the way you eat for the rest of your life. And so when you think about it that way, okay, what's going to be my lifestyle in terms of what I'm going to eat? Well, then obviously you have to eat a diet that's going to decrease your risk of chronic health. I mean, you know, and look, there's only one diet ever proven to reverse heart disease, number one killer of men and women, at least here in the States and around much of the world, and that's a plant-based diet. So anytime someone tries to sell you on some new diet they've heard about, you know, do me a favor, ask them, wait a second, has this diet been proven to reverse heart disease? You know, the number one or two reason me and all my loved ones will die? The answer is no. Why would you even consider it? And the fact that can also be useful in preventing, arresting, or reversing other leading killers, like, you know, diabetes and high blood pressure, seem to make the case just overwhelming. You know, like, if that's all a plant-based diet can do, reverse the number one or two killer men and women around the world, shouldn't that be the default diet until proven otherwise? I mean, it's just like, and so, I mean, that's the science we want, is we want hard endpoints. We want disease endpoints. So not like, oh, well, this diet, we can change your cholesterol or biomarker or weight loss, short-term weight loss. It's like, well, yeah, no, but are you dying? The only reason we care about cholesterol is or weight or, the, you know, is because we're worried about diabetes, we're worried about heart disease, we're worried about, you know, and we have data where we can actually reverse some of these diseases with this diet. And so until someone can show that kind of data, so you don't see, you know, heart disease reversal on a low-carb diet. You know, it's never been a controlled study showing majority of patients reverse. I mean, it's just right? In fact, you see the opposite. You see people worse. What upsets me is that this is not just some, like, academic discussion, right? I mean, it's not like someone saying, no, you should buy my brand of headphones or my music player versus some other music player. It's like, well, who cares what decision you make, right? this, we're talking about, I mean, but that's the kind of the same level of, oh, yeah, I like this. Oh, what's your favorite band? Or what's your favorite, you know, oh, yeah, what's your diet, right? No, no, we're talking life and death here. I mean, we're talking the health of your family, your loved ones. And so if there's ever a decision in our life to actually put some forethought into, to actually dig up and say, wait a second, show me the evidence. I actually want to see, you know, if you're buying a new toaster, who cares what the evidence is? I mean, you can't dig deep into the evidence on every decision we make in our life. You get nothing done, right? But if there's a few things where you want to be like, okay, I'm not going to trust your opinion or your belief or your dogma. I actually want to dig and convince myself that what I'm doing is right. It should be something that has literally life and death consequences, right? I mean, you know, if there's ever anything that calls for, you know, really getting to the truth of the matter, it would be something that actually affects how long you're going to be on this planet, how healthy you're going to be. And if you do, and so that's what my work is. I'm looking at nutrition facts. It's not me saying it. I'm just like, there's the study. There's the quote. There's the graph. There's the chart. You know, here's the link. You can download the PDF, read the whole thing yourself. You read the primary literature. You know, this is what the science says. And I know, yes, we're in a post-truth society, right? That was the Oxford Dictionary 2016 word of the year, new word of the year, post-truth. But it turns out facts really do matter. So that's why we'll continue to keep up the good fight.
And your newest book, it's called How Not to Die, and there you name the top 15 leading causes of death worldwide. And number one, it's heart disease. So does it matter in terms of this number one killer, what we eat?
How we eat is all that matters, really, when it comes to heart. I mean, there are other disease risk factors, like smoking increases your risk of heart disease. But if your cholesterol is low enough, then there shouldn't be enough substrate to really build up these plaques in our arteries, which cause the disease that lead to heart attacks and this leading cause of death worldwide now. And so, look, again, one diet can prevent, arrest, and even reverse plant-based diet, the only diet that's ever been shown to do so. It's a slam dunk. We've known since July 23rd, 1990, with the publication of Dean Ornish's landmark lifestyle heart trial in The Lancet, the probably most prestigious medical journal in the world, proving with something called quantitative angiography that you could eat reverse heart disease, open up arteries without drugs, without surgery, just a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle behaviors. Ever since then, basically, effectively the cure, once we found the cure, not a single person really should have died since then of this preventable, arrestable, reversible disease. Yet hundreds of thousands of people here in the States alone continue to die of this disease. And it's unconscionable. That's why I do what I do. I mean, that's what led me down this whole path. I'm like, wait a second. Effectively, the cure to our number one killer, because you had lost down some rabbit hole and ignored what else might there be in the medical literature that, you know, could help my patients, but just didn't have a corporate budget driving its promotion. Well, I made it my life's mission to find out. That's why I started NutritionFacts.org, and that's why I wrote the book, How Not to Die.
All right. Wow, Dr. Greger, thank you so much. It's really remarkable to see what you achieved so far, and it's really an honor to speak with you about all these topics. So can you share with us in your book, How Not to Die, you stated that the whole food plant-based diet is something like a one-size-fits-all approach on nutrition. And you stated that there is just one diet that fights against the most common Western diseases. So is it true that there is one approach on nutrition for everyone out there?
With little tweaks. So there are particular foods that appear to be particularly effective towards one cancer or another. And, you know, hibiscus tea and flax seeds, for example, appear to be particularly helpful for hypertension or something. So basically, it's a very similar prescription. I think that's extraordinary in itself, the fact that the same diet, it's not like there's a heart-healthy diet that's somehow different from a brain-healthy diet. No. Heart healthy diet is a brain healthy diet, is a liver healthy diet, is a kidney healthy diet, is a whole body healthy diet, kind of one diet to rule them all, this whole plant food diet. You say, wait a second, how could one diet do all that? Well, look, many of our chronic diseases have inflammatory components. So eating an anti-inflammatory diet, it would make sense, it would affect a large number of organ systems. Also, every organ in our body relies on circulation to get nutrients and oxygen to remove waste products. And so, you know, atherosclerosis is a systemic disease. It doesn't just clog up in your heart. That's what may kill you, but it can also clog up other places, causing erectile dysfunction or strokes or peripheral vascular disease or kidney disease, right? Our kidneys are highly vascular organs. That's why at the butcher shop, you see they're bright red because they're filled with blood vessels. And so you can imagine you clog up those blood vessels. No wonder that the three dietary risk factors of decline in kidney function, according to Harvard research, is animal protein, animal fat, and cholesterol. I only found one place in these animal products. Well, no surprise that eating a heart healthy, a blood vessel healthy, a circulation healthy diet would help with the kidneys and every other organ that relies on circulation, which is every single organ, right? And so when you think about it, maybe it's not so strange that the same diet would be beneficial to all these organ systems. You go down the list. There are certainly some things that we have no control over, relatively no. I mean, we still get hit by a bus. You can say, well, don't walk across the street. Okay, yeah, you can. But, I mean, you know, we still got to, you know, wear our bike helmets and stop smoking and practice safer sex and all down the list. But the good news is we have tremendous power over our health, destiny, and longevity. The vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle behaviors. It's really it's a no-brainer when it comes to the direction we need to go to start eating healthier.
All right, perfect. And the second half of the book is all about the daily dozen. So a list of foods that you should include in your diet on a daily basis. Could you share with us the concept behind those daily dozen?
And so, on nutritionfacts.org, at this point, like 1,400 videos or something, covering about 2,000 topics. And so, it's a little overwhelming. So that's why one of the reasons I wrote the book, at least the first half of How Not to Die, is I really wanted to compile the most compelling evidence into one place. So that's why I talk about the role diet may play in preventing, arresting, and reversing each of our 15 leading causes of death, kind of one chapter on each, thousands of scientific citations, but I didn't want it to just be a reference book. I wanted to be kind of a practical guide on translating this mountain of evidence into day-to-day kind of grocery store decisions. And so that's what became really the second half of the book, where I talk about where I center my recommendations around this daily dozen list of things I encourage that I try to fit into my own daily diet, encourage other people to try too. And it's not about perfection. Certainly when I'm traveling, it's rare that I can eat as healthy as I like. But when I have control over my diet, I really do try to fit in as much as possible. So, I go through and just based on the available evidence, encourage people to eat a tablespoon of ground flaxseeds every day, a quarter teaspoon of turmeric, berries every day, the healthiest fruits, greens every day, the healthiest vegetables, specifically cruciferous vegetables. I want people, I talk about the healthiest beverages, the healthiest sweeteners, how much exercise they get every day. I mean, just all the questions we typically have, like here's the best available balance of evidence on each of these topics. And look, if on one day you don't do as good as you'd like, the next day do a little better. And, it doesn't really matter what you eat on your birthdays, holidays, special occasions. On a day-to-day basis, though, we really should try to eat as clean a diet as possible.
And another great point that you made during your talk at the VegMed Congress in Berlin in 2016 was when you compared the health effects of food, healthy food, with the health effects of exercise. And you made a very interesting point in the effects of those two. Could you share this with us?
Oh, well, certainly. So this has been looked at for a number of different chronic conditions in terms of like obesity, what role does inactivity versus poor diet play? And it turns out it's very difficult to kind of outrun a bad diet. We're just so efficient. Our bodies are so efficient that if you calculate, wait a second, what one Oreo cookie, I'd have to climb how many stairs to burn off? You're like, well, that's impossible. There's just no way, right? And so then you're like, I better not eat that Oreo cookie, right? Unless I got an extra hour today to. I think in that particular talk, I was talking about cancer suppression. So there was a Oh, so the after Dr. Dean Ornish and his colleagues basically conquered our number one killer, heart disease, moved on to killer number two, cancer, which may actually be the leading killer in Germany. Yeah, so and so then they took on cancer, and they found that the same diet was able to reverse the progression, on average, reverse the progression of early stage prostate cancer, same diet and lifestyle behaviors. And so they're like, wait, what is going on? And so what they did is they just took the blood of people eating kind of the standard Western diet, drip that blood onto cancer cells growing in petri dish, human cancer cells, and could just show that, you could suppress cancer growth by about 9%, a few percent. But we put people on a plant-based diet for a year, though, and their blood can, suppress cancer growth about 8 times better, about 70% decrease in growth. They tried this with women and breast cancer, same remarkable findings, increase in what's called apoptosis, programmed cell death. Their body's able to kind of reprogram cancer cells, forcing them to early retirement. It just showed how dramatically we could strengthen our cancer defenses within literally days, right? Some of these studies were 2 weeks. Put people on a healthy diet, and you see this remarkable increase in the ability of your bloodstream to suppress cancer growth, to kill off cancers. And so it raises the question, what kind of blood do we want in our body? What kind of immune system, right? Do we want blood that just kind of rolls over when new cancer cells pop up? Do we want blood that circulates every nook and cranny in our body with the power to slow down and stop it? We can make our bloodstream inhospitable to cancer within weeks of just eating healthy. That was really the remarkable thing. But critics were like, well, wait a second. You had these women doing two things. You had them on a plant-based diet, but also you had them exercising. You had them out walking 30 to 60 minutes a day. So wait a second. You do two things. How do you know what role the diet plays versus exercise? So researchers then put it to the test, where they compared people who plant-based diet for an average of 14 years, along with daily mild exercise, like out walking every day, compared to those who for 14 years kind of standard American diet, but 14 years of daily strenuous hour-long exercise like calisthenics. Now they wanted to know if you exercise long enough, if you exercise hard enough, can you rival some strolling plant eaters over there? And it turns out certainly compared to someone who is inactive eating a standard Western diet, exercising for literally 5,000 hours can significantly improve your cancer defenses, your cancer cell clearance. But nothing appears to kick more cancer tush than a plant-based diet. So even better than – so 5,000 hours, you can knock out cancer cells left and right, but even – there was a significant boost in cancer cell clearance in those who were just, out walking every day, more mild, moderate exercise, eating a healthier diet. So diet really does trump some of these other, lifestyle behaviors. But that's not to say that sleep isn't important, exercise is important, smoking cessation isn't important. But diet, so if you look at, for example, the global burden of disease study, the largest study of human risk factors for disease in human history, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, previously funded by the World Bank, the number one cause of death in countries like the United States is our diet. And same thing with Germany, same thing with I think every country that I visited where I made a particular – where I looked at dug up the data, number one cause of death and disability is the diet. Using tobacco is number two. So here in the States, the cigarettes only kill about 500,000 Americans every year, whereas our diet kills hundreds of thousands of more. So most deaths in Western countries are preventable and related to nutrition.
Another interesting topic is oil. Many people think that due to the Mediterranean diet, olive oil and other heart healthy oils are particularly good, but I think the body of evidence suggests something differently, right? Could you share this with us?
I think the best available balance of evidence suggests that indeed oils are not good for us. In fact, processed foods in general are not good for us. But the whole plant foods, regardless of whether they're high-fat whole foods like nuts, seeds, avocados, or low-fat whole plant foods, are health-promoting. And so, for example, if you look at the Adventist studies, it appears that adding, you know, a small handful, like an ounce of nuts to one's daily diet, or at least 5 times a week, or more, may add as much as 2 years to your lifespan. So these were, you know, people eating healthy, those eating nuts lived about 2 years longer than those eating healthy who were not eating nuts. And so that's pretty remarkable that kind of like a single food could have that effect. You say, well, that's an observational study. Maybe nut eaters were health nuts and exercised more or something. Well, that brings us to studies like PREDIMED, where they actually randomized people at high cardiovascular disease risk to either eat nuts or not eat nuts. Basically, they sent people free nuts every week. They just mailed them free nuts and encouraged them to eat them. And indeed, those that got free nuts ate more nuts. And after a few-year period, those that ate randomized into the eat more nut group had half the strokes that those who weren't eating more nuts. And now, look, they were still having strokes, right? But they were having half as many strokes. So you could say both ways. You can be like, eating nuts may appears to cut your stroke risk in half, or not eating nuts doubles your stroke risk. That's basically effectively the same, right? And so it's like, wait a second. If I don't eat this, I'm going to double my – well, then you eat that, right? So so walnuts are probably the healthiest. So if you dig into that PREDIMED data, walnuts may be the healthiest, whether it's because of the highest antioxidant nut or the highest omega-3 nut. We're not sure. But, yeah, so if you had a choice, walnuts. So I try to eat nuts every day. It's part of my daily dozen.
All right, Dr. Greger, thank you very much. You already mentioned the role of walnuts for our daily supply of omega-3 fatty acids. But what about supplementing these long-chained omega-3 acids, EPA and DHA? Would you recommend to supplement those?
So I have a series of videos on fish oil, on long-chain omega-3s, fatty acids in general. So it's not heart health, but for long-term cognitive health in older age, I do encourage people to stay away from fish and get pollutant-free sources of long-chain fatty acids. So that would be an algae-based supplemental source. So 250 milligrams of a pollutant-free, meaning algae-based, DHA would probably be a good idea until we have better data. And that's, of course, in addition to the most important supplemental recommendation one can make, and that's ensuring everyone eating healthy gets a regular, reliable dose of vitamin B12. And if you're not getting enough daily sun, everybody needs to get vitamin D somewhere, somehow.
Right, Dr. Greger, thank you so much for sharing your recommendations with us. You already mentioned the Global Burden of Disease study, one of the largest and most comprehensive studies ever conducted. In terms of the food that we should eat on a daily basis, what can we learn from the Global Burden of Disease study?
Yeah, so the Global Burden of Disease study, the largest study on human risk factors for death and disability, it involved, 500 researchers. Who could possibly fund such an incredible undertaking? Indeed, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And so then they can answer questions like, oh, well, so how many people does drinking soda kill? How many people does eating processed meat kill every year? If you look at the leading, and they talked about all risk factors from car accidents to, but in terms of diet, the number one dietary risk factor for death was inadequate fruit consumption. So not eating enough fruit kills more people than, eating schnitzel or eating, what we include in our diet actually may be as important as what we exclude from our diet. I think number two leading killer dietary risk factor is not eating enough nuts and seeds. I think three was not eating enough vegetables. I forget exactly what the next few on the list, but it's in the book, How Not to Die. I think I talk about it in my high blood pressure chapter, and the reason is because that's why we think fruit may be so protective, because
The number one risk factor for death in the world is hypertension, because it contributes not only to heart disease, but to stroke and kidney failure and some other problems. And eating a healthy diet, including high potassium, high fiber, etc., can lower one's risk of high blood pressure.
But still, many people are afraid of fruits and because of their sugar content. But you made an excellent video showing that you could eat tremendous amount of fruit and still have good health outcomes. Could you share this with us?
Yeah, I mean, this study looked at over 20 servings of fruits a day. This was at the Jenkins Lab at the University of Toronto. He's the guy that invented the glycemic index, very prestigious research team. And so they said, well, let's just see what happens if we just pile the fruit on. And the reason that one might be concerned about the sugars within fruit is because industrial sugars like table sugar, high fructose corn syrup, they damage the liver, they increase fat in the liver, they increase our high blood pressure, increase our triglycerides, increase our risk for weight gain. But what happened when they ate sugar in natural form, the way nature intended, packed all those phytonutrients, fiber, etc., the opposite happened. Actually, their risk factors got better. So in terms of improving liver function and, you know, decreasing insulin resistance, etc. So, you know, anyone who suggests fruit isn't good for you, I mean, that's the, I mean, it's kind of the global scientific community has come together and agreed that's in fact the most important thing that the world's community could do to improve their health is eat more fruit.
So we could summarize, there's no adverse effect of eating a lot of fruit.
Unless you're eating Fruit Loops.
Next one got a bit tough one. There has been this hypothesis that a high amount of animal protein in the diet leads to a higher loss of calcium through the urine, and therefore people might think that it leads to calcium loss from the bones. But in your book, you made clear that it's not the fact. Could you share with us why is this hypothesis wrong? What was the reason why people thought it would be like this, and what is the truth?
Sure. For most of the last century, actually, this is what all the nutrition community understood, that, this going back to, I think, 1912 was really the first study. You can do this, very reproducible. If you give somebody a protein load, what happens is there's a spike in urine calcium loss. And so you basically feed somebody a steak, and then you just measure their calcium levels in the urine, and it spikes up. Which makes sense because animal protein in particular have these sulfur-containing amino acids, which are metabolized into sulfuric acid. And how do you, you know, buffer acid with an antacid, like, you know, calcium, you know, tons of calcium. And so calcium can be used to buffer acid. So where is your body going to get calcium from? Well, I mean, most of the calcium is stored in your skeleton. So the thought is when we eat, particularly animal protein, we get this loss of calcium from urine. Where is it coming from? Presumably it's coming from our bones. You can even quantify it. I think like 45 grams of protein led to like 50 milligrams loss of calcium. You only have a couple pounds of calcium in your body, locked in your skeleton. So, you know, you could lose, you know, 1 or 2% of bone mass every year at that kind of rate. And so there was this, you know, we got to cut down on animal protein to save our bones. Otherwise, we're peeing our bones down the toilet. This was not some kind of vegan theory. This was the mainstream nutrition communities theory until a very famous study actually put it to the test and found out the whole theory was wrong. That's what we love about science, is that it's correctable. When we have new evidence, we change the theory. So what happened is they basically fed some intrepid research subjects some radioactive calcium, some calcium tagged so we could actually track it through the body. And then, you know, fed them a steak, and got a big spike of calcium in their urine, like always happens. And the question was that radioactive calcium or not? Why does that matter? Well, if it's radioactive calcium, it's not coming from your bones, it's coming from your diet. And that's indeed what happened. So about 90% of that spike in calcium was actually through your diet, meaning that protein ingestion dramatically boosts calcium absorption. So if you eat a meal, then the broccoli that you had next to your steak, the calcium is just absorbed that much better. So all of a sudden you get this, because of the protein, boost in calcium absorption. You get all this extra calcium in your blood. Your kidneys are like, oh, wow, can't have too much calcium. So gets rid of it through your kidneys. And so that's why we saw that spike. And indeed, you can take people, feed them that steak, and also feed them these alkali salts, basically to kind of buffer it before it even gets into your system. And what happens? You still get a calcium spike. It's not your body draining calcium stores from your bones. It's that that boosted absorption. I mean, most of it is. About 90% of it is. I mean, if you ate kind of an Atkins-like diet, then one could imagine actually losing some. Caffeine's a problem. Sodium's a problem. You can get calcium loss, genuine calcium loss, from a variety of sources. Probably the most important thing we can do for our bones is a weight-bearing exercise. It's kind of a use it or lose it. That will maintain our skeletal structure. Not to say that acid-forming foods isn't bad for us, right? So eating foods that form acids in our body, like animal protein, increase our risk of kidney stones and gout and potentially muscle mass loss as we age, all sorts. But in terms of our skeleton, that is something that the scientific community, you know, dumped like a decade ago. But unfortunately, some people haven't got the memo.
All right, Dr. Greger, thank you very much for your explanation on this one. So as we still have to buffer the acid load from protein-rich foods, but we already learned that we do not buffer it with the calcium from the bones, how can we buffer it otherwise?
Oh, well, actually, it may come from our muscles. So there's an amino acid within our muscles that our body can pull from to buffer any kind of pH imbalances. And so that's why we think that there's this kind of muscle wasting as we get older, and that's tied with the kind of acid-base balance in terms of diet. So there's, you know, other reasons to continue to stay away from animal protein, even just from kind of an acid-base balance standpoint. But not so much for the bones.
All right, Dr. Greger, once again, thank you very much for your explanation. But this still leaves us with the question why we still see higher osteoporosis rates in countries with more milk consumption. Do we have any other explanation for this?
We think it's actually due to the galactose, which is a part of the lactose sugar within dairy. So, there's been this long-standing, we've long understood relationship between the countries with the highest dairy consumption actually had the highest hip fracture rates. And so that was kind of a conundrum. Why is that the case? There's all sorts of theories going back and forth. The concept that milk is protective of bones doesn't pan out whether you're drinking milk as a teen, drinking milk as an adult, just doesn't work. Look at any of the recent meta-analyses, it's just no protection, hip fracture protection, for example. And indeed, actually get the reverse. It's like, wait a second, why would there be more fracture risk? So Swedish researchers tried to put it to the test, followed over 100,000 men and women for years, and found that milk-drinking women not only had high rates of death and cancer and heart disease, et cetera, but they had more fracture rates, more milk, more fractures. Men also had higher rates of death, we think it's actually the milk sugar, not the milk protein.
All right, Dr. Greger, once again, thank you very much for updating us in this important topic. Can you share with us how could it be that low-carb evangelists still negate the negative effect of saturated fatty acids on our health?
Well, I talk about the the, you know, kind of saturated fat and cholesterol skeptics. I've got a bunch of videos about it. I mean, it's basically, I mean, it's like, you know, wait a second. What about all those, you know, studies that the tobacco industry cites saying that smoking not only is not bad for you, but actually good for you? It's like, okay, well, yeah, indeed, the tobacco industry used to have a stack of 100 studies saying smoking is good for you. And it's true, smoking may, you know, impair your immune system enough that it could help with ulcerative colitis. The nicotine may help with schizophrenia. I mean, there's a couple of things, look, you can show, but that's not what the best available balance of evidence shows, right? I mean, so, I mean, you can cherry pick around and make all sorts of, you know, crazy claims. But if you look at the best available balance of evidence, then it's very clear that, you know, saturated fat, particularly certain types of saturated fat, like found meat and dairy, increase one's risk of increasing one's LDL, which is primarily the number one risk factor or conventional risk factor for heart disease, number one killer. I mean, it's, you know, in fact, and, you know, we have interventional studies. You take people, you remove sources of saturated fat from the diet, right, like the Ornish, Esselstyn, et cetera, and you can get a reversal of heart disease, and you get the opposite, right? I mean, when you people go on low-carb diets, you can actually see, you know, their heart clogging off. You can do these angiographic studies. I have some beautiful pictures from Fleming's lab that I show. I mean, it's just, it's not even, I mean, it's not a, you know, in fact, cholesterol skeptics are referred to as flat earthers in the medical literature. I mean, it's just like it's so, you know, I mean, the only reason they can get away with saying things like that is because people aren't scientifically literate. They either don't have access to the medical literature or haven't read the medical literature. But, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, there's a reason why every major medical institution in the world, right, from the World Health Organization, American Heart Association, National Institutes of Medicine, I mean, National Institutes of Health, Institute of Medicine, I mean, they're all, I mean, on the same board, right? In fact, the American Heart Association recommends pushing saturated fat down people at high risk for heart disease like 6-7%. I mean, that's, you know, basically they're telling people to, you know, eat a vegan diet 6 out of 7 days a week, basically, in terms of how that, you know, how far one has to push down the intake of those kinds of foods. Though there are saturated plant foods too, I encourage people to stay away from palm kernel oil and coconut oil and, you know, et cetera.
If we switch the topic now, what would you tell to people that say they don't want to include nightshades like tomatoes, eggplants, bell peppers into their diet because they're afraid that nightshades are harmful for our health?
There are rare individuals. So, for example, 1 in 20 people with joint pain may actually improve by cutting nightshades out of their diet. But it's just like, look, if someone, you know, there's some people, they eat a peanut and literally they drop over dead, right? I mean, not just they get sick, they die. So are peanuts bad for you? Well, peanuts are bad for that person, right? But I mean, you can't make that blanket statement. Just like people with celiac disease can't eat wheat. That doesn't mean wheat isn't bad for other people. And the same thing with nightshades. And in fact, you know, there's all sorts of amazing health benefits tied to tomato consumption. In fact, there are interventional studies where they give people tomato paste and wonderful things happen. Or they, or, you know, the Parkinson's disease data with bell peppers. People who eat more bell peppers, lower risk getting Parkinson's. I mean, there's all sorts of, I mean, you know, so we should keep healthy foods in our diet unless proven otherwise. And look, people have, you know, food sensitivities and, you know, some people are allergic to various foods and obviously, you know, but they are healthful foods for the vast majority of people.
And what can we say about the comparison of the micronutrient content of organic food versus non-organic food? Is there really a difference between those two? But what is the difference in terms of antioxidant content between organic and non-organic? So what should we choose on a daily basis?
Right, so I have a series of videos talking about both the safety and the nutrient content. So conventional nutrients like vitamins and minerals, very similar, conventional versus organic. But when it comes to phytonutrients, some of these protective compounds, protective both for the plants and for us, tend to be higher in organic foods, but like 50% higher, for example. But look, they can be, you know, conventionally grown foods can be 50% less expensive. So in terms of per dollar, are we actually getting more nutrition? I think more important question is, well, what about safety? You know, people don't, you know, buy organic because they think they're going to get more vitamin C in their apple or something. They're concerned about pesticides. And so I talk in the book about a study published in this journal called Food Chemical Toxicology that was kind of modeling study done here in the States that suggests that if half of Americans ate a single more serving of fruits or vegetables every year, we would prevent 20,000 cancer cases every year. That's how powerful fruits and vegetables are. But because they're talking about conventional fruits and vegetables, pesticide-laden fruits and vegetables, that extra pesticide load would actually cause 10 cases of cancer. So overall, we would just prevent 19,990 cancer cases if we told people to eat more fruits and vegetables. So that just gives you a sense of the tremendous benefit versus this tiny bump in risk. You say, wait a second, why accept any risk at all when I can buy organic? Perfect, fine, that's great, but we should never let concern over pesticides prevent us from stuffing our face with as many fruits and vegetables as possible. And that blueberries example, nothing should prevent you from eating more blueberries.
Okay, good point. Before we come to the final question, one very controversial topic, at least here in Europe, are microwaves. Many people think that preparing food in a microwave could be potentially harmful for them. Is there any scientific basis to say that?
I mean, if you dropped it on your foot, I mean, but no, I mean, there's just no, I mean, so you just have to, so when someone comes up with some kind of unconventional idea, your answer, particularly when it comes to something as life or death important as one's diet, is show me the science. Like, look, I'm open-minded. Show me the science, right? And no one can give it, and what the, you know, and what they'll do is they'll forward you some spam email they got that's been dismissed by Snopes as a total fraud. I mean, these kind of things. It's just like, I mean, there's no evidence to suggest that microwaving foods is bad for you. I mean, if you look at the literature, there's things that people have like had gotten burns from like overheating things, and then they, you know, and then it explodes or something. I mean, that's the adverse effects of microwaves, basically burns. What else? Yeah, now of course it matters what you're microwaving, right? Obviously, right? I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, if you're making some, we have these horrible foods called Hot Pockets, which is like bacon and cheese hot pie, right? It doesn't matter how you cook that. It's going to be horrible for you. Microwave popcorn, bad idea, right? Because they're typically, you know, they have that artificial butter flavor, which can increase one risk for lung disease. Lots of, you know, typically trans fats or historically trans fats. But healthy foods, I mean, the reason I like microwaves so much is because it can make it more convenient to eat healthy foods, right? So instead of setting up your steamer, waiting for water to boil to steam some broccoli, right, throw it in the microwave for a minute or two and poof, broccoli right there, and throw it on whatever else you're eating. And so look, anything that can make healthy food more convenient, definitely go for it. And in fact, it's one of the most nutrient-sparing cooking methods. So, it's better to microwave your broccoli than it is to certainly boil your broccoli or, you know, whatever. So, I love my microwave, and it helps me eat healthier. I mean, you can do a search. Anyone can go to PubMed, right, pubmed.gov, which is the largest medical library in the world. And you type in microwaves and /AE, which is adverse effects, and look yourself. Or you put microwaves and cancer, microwaves, whatever. It just doesn't exist. It exists in people's minds. So it's just like, you know, how else can we make decisions about important things but by the best available balance of evidence? And so, some people just believe stuff, you know, like, well, the Martians told me through my tinfoil hat that I shouldn't eat food X. Okay, but, you know, unless you have some data to give me, then, you know, I'm a rational creature and I want to make evidence-based decisions.
All right. And as always, the final question, what is the key message that you want to share with the audience?
The key message is that is good news. The vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a healthy enough plant-based diet and other lifestyle behaviors. And so, you know, the power is within our hands, at the ends of our forks, but only if we exercise it.